Welcome to Oncology Today, PARP inhibitors in the management of ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Antonio Gonzalez-Martin from the Clínica Universidad de Navarra in Madrid, Spain. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video component with Dr. Gonzalez-Martin's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to comment on the characteristics of the different subtypes of ovarian cancer. I'd like you to start out with what characterizes high-grade serous, the fraction of cases, the biologic profile, but also get into the other four subtypes of ovarian cancer. So can you paint a picture of right now your vision for how ovarian cancer is subclassified?
That is a critical question, actually, because I guess that in the near future, we will not treat all the patients in the same way. Even now, we are starting to individualize therapy according to the histology. So as I said, there are five different subtypes, which are high-grade serous, low-grade serous, endometrioid, clear cell, and the mucinous tumor. We can argue that we also have the undifferentiated. For some people, undifferentiated is one of these five types that has not been well identified. So let's say that we have five subtypes. Globally speaking, 5% of our patients do have early stage, and 75% will have advanced stage. In the advanced stage, high-grade serous is, I would say, not only the most frequent, it's almost the main reason of advanced ovarian cancer, is 85% of the cases. But in the early stage, there is a distribution of the other subtypes. So mucinous is typically early stage tumor. Endometrioid is also typically early stage tumor. And clear cell cancer is also typically an early stage tumor. Low grade may be early or advanced, but it's a very uncommon disease. One of the common features of low-grade, clear cell, and mucinous is that they are uncommon histologies. We consider they're rare diseases. They have a completely different origin. For instance, in the high-grade serous, the origin is the TP53 mutation that is behind the biological process starting that tumor. But in the low-grade tumors, it seems to be an evolution of tumors of low malignant potential. We have other type of alterations. In particular, we have seen KRAS mutation or BRAF mutation. The clear cell is associated to endometriosis, which is very interesting. And one of the alterations is ARID1A and also PA3K mutations. Finally, the mucinous tumor, which is the most rare disease in epithelial ovarian cancer, we can see KRAS mutation, HER2 amplification. But when you are facing a patient with mucinous tumor in the ovary, what you need to rule out first is a metastasis from a gastrointestinal or hepatobiliary tumor.
Just in terms of the issue of HRD and the potential use of PARP inhibitors and even anything we know about PARP inhibitors, do we have any information on any of these subtypes other than high-grade serous? From a practical perspective, is there a reason to think about getting genomic testing considering a PARP inhibitor if you have one of these other subtypes?
That's a great question. Honestly, no patients with histologies different to high-grade serous or endometrioid were included in the randomized trials that have given the approval of these drugs. But having said this, I think that in the case of BRCA-mutated tumors, even if they are clear cell or low grade, I think that we should consider the use of PARP inhibitors. I'm not sure about the value in homologous recombination deficient clear cell tumor because probably this is something not very well studied. But we know that some patients with clear cell mutation in BRCA, for sure that I would consider PARP inhibitor in those patients.
So caught my eye when I saw that there was HER2 amplification in the mucinous, even though I know you said it was very uncommon, but nowadays we're always having a radar out for HER2 of anything because of the antibody drug conjugate trastuzumab deratuxan that's been so interesting in breast and GI and lung cancer. Anywhere else that you see HER2 amplification or mutations in ovarian cancer?
No. Approximately the rate of HER2 mutation or amplification in ovarian cancer is less than 5%. So it's something that you can find. But in the mucinous, it is up to 20-25%. And that is a disease that mostly is found in early stage and you can cure the patient with surgery. But in the case of relapse, in the case of a stage or a stage 3 from the beginning, it is a very hard disease because it is very chemo-resistant. Any option of targeted therapy is very much appreciated. And why in the mucinous tumor, I strongly recommend our physician, our colleagues, to ask the pathology for the HER2 testing because it's open the patient another opportunity of therapy.
One other biologic question. I was surprised. I didn't realize that high-grade serous has so much frequency of TP53 mutations. Almost all the patients have it. Any specific clinical implications and any research implications? I hear about TP53 getting targeted in like hematologic cancers. Has that been something that's been looked at with ovarian?
Well, actually, this is a universal alteration in high-grade serous ovarian cancer. We have had a couple of attempts of clinical trials. One was trying to restore the P53 function, but that trial has not been presented so far. And the other is the use of Wee inhibitors that somehow can also be active in these patients with P53 mutation, and it's a way of research.
Interesting. So let's kind of get into practical clinical decision-making in terms of PARP inhibitors and ovarian cancer. Always a great challenge. And I guess I want to start out, I mean, I'm reflecting back on what I've been hearing from investigators for the last couple of years. And one of the big questions, of course, relates to bevacizumab. And kind of, it seems, talking to people, doing surveys, et cetera, it seems like the decision about whether or not to use Bev is almost, at least in the beginning, separate. That you look at the patient at some point and say, you know, I think I want to give that patient Bev. And then you start deciding, are you also going to use a PARP inhibitor? Are you going to use a PARP inhibitor instead? But that people look at the decision about PARP and which PARP, et cetera, and Bev in the beginning separately. Is that the way you do it?
Well, not exactly. I think that nowadays we have two different algorithms. One algorithm for making decisions is based on the use of bevacizumab. So the first decision that you make is, am I going to use bevacizumab, yes or not? And then according to that decision, you make the second decision in the maintenance to use or not PARP inhibitor. That is one way to do that. Personally, it's not my preferred option because somehow it is like to have an algorithm based on a drug. I prefer to have algorithm based on clinical or biological features of the patient, something that do not depend on reimbursement, approvals. So that's the reason why I prefer to base the decision on the biomarker. First BRCA mutation, then homologous recombination deficiency. And when you know that data, make the decision about how to treat the patient. But that is not the only thing. You also have to put in the decision process the stage, the extension of the disease, if the patient was operated or not from the beginning, the residual tumor, how the patient did respond to therapy. So there are many factors that you have to consider. But you are right. The decision of bevacizumab is made very early in the first or second cycle of therapy. But the decision of PARP inhibitor is made at the end of chemotherapy. So there are two moments, two timing for the decision.
Well, if you kind of think about the clinical paths that patients take, I guess broadly, they're either going to go to surgery up front or get neoadjuvant therapy. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. So, for example, in the patient who goes to surgery up front, how do you decide whether you're going to use bevacizumab post-op?
Okay. So, for a long time, I would say, we thought that the great benefit of bevacizumab after primary debulking surgery was, I wouldn't say restricted, but mainly observed in patients with high-risk futures. But this is important because now that opened you a new reflection, how the concept of high risk has been changing in the last years, depending on inclusion criteria of the different trials. When we said that bevacizumab was more active in high-risk patients, we were talking about stage 4 and stage 3 with macroscopic residual tumor after primary surgery larger than 1 centimeter. That was high risk at that time. But we demonstrated in a sub-analysis of the ICON 7 that bevacizumab was also worked in the group of patients with complete cytoreduction. So the decision of using bevacizumab in the old times when we didn't have PARP inhibitors was essentially based on other things like approvals, reimbursement, things like that, because the benefit was there for patients with complete cytoreduction. We didn't have any biomarker, clinical or biologic biomarker, for the selection of the bevacizumab. But now things have changed. Now we have the PARP inhibitors, and we have to decide if we put everything in the front line or if we try to have something like a sequential use of the targeted therapy in ovarian cancer. And this is the great discussion that we have nowadays in our meetings, in our advisories, and even with our patients. So answering your question, I feel that bevacizumab is important in patients with poor response to chemotherapy and probably patients with a great amount of disease, stage 4, or huge ascites or pleural effusion, things like that.
So in those patients, of course, you have the potential option of also using a PARP inhibitor. And of course, you have the Paola 1 study that looks at olaparib, and at least in the United States, that's approved as an option. But as we'll get into in terms of the issue of PARP inhibitor, there are patients that more likely are going to receive niraparib. And I guess the one subset would be, not everybody does it, but HRD negative. Theoretically, they could receive niraparib. The hazard rate's not as good as with BRCA, but still pretty good. And you could imagine doing that. So I guess one question I have is, in that situation, how would you feel about combining niraparib and Bev?
So as you said, the use of niraparib is restricted to patients with homologous recombination deficient and proficient. When you are facing a patient with homologous recombination deficient tumor, you have to split your patients into groups, those that are BRCA mutated and BRCA non-mutated. Our feeling, or the feeling of several investigators, is that for a patient that is BRCA mutated, the best treatment is PARP inhibitor alone. Maybe that there are some subgroups in which you may consider the addition of bevacizumab, those patients that are clinically in high risk, but you also have to consider safety, convenience of administration, and many other factors for treating BRCA mutated patients. The only information that we have is an indirect comparison of Solo 1 and Paola 1 for the BRCA mutated patients. It seems to be an additive effect, but the methodology behind is not completely, in my opinion, accurate, because they are comparing events of two trials in which the events were measured at different time points. So all the statistical methodology behind is very good, but I'm not sure if we can compare the events directly between both trials. So that's the reason why, in my opinion, the use of bevacizumab in addition to PARP inhibitor olaparib in frontline BRCA mutated patient is not completely defined. We need more information. The other group is the BRCA wild-type homologous recombination deficient, and I think that this is an excellent combination for those patients. I really think that this is a very good combination for those patients. There is a clear increment, and if you are considering bevacizumab in that patients, you should consider the Paola trial for sure. And if you are not considering bevacizumab, then you have the option of niraparib. So in summary, for homologous recombination deficient, bevacizumab should be considered in the BRCA wild type, if you think that bevacizumab is adding effect to the patient, in the BRCA mutated, I have more doubts.
So what about the HRD negative patient? First of all, putting aside reimbursement issues, do you offer, for example, niraparib to those patients? Would you?
That's another hot topic today. One of the great conclusions from the PARP inhibitor frontline trials is that we have identified a clear group of patients with homologous recombination proficient tumors. Those patients definitively have a worse prognosis. The combination of bevacizumab and olaparib is not working there if you compare with bevacizumab. And we don't have data comparing bevacizumab and niraparib PARP inhibitor. So how to make decisions in this situation? I don't think that one option fits all, and we have to individualize the therapy. I would like to remind that the patients that were included in the PRIMA study were patients with high-risk disease, but also a good response to platinum-based therapy. I think that could be a surrogate for the use of PARP inhibitor niraparib in the HRP group. I'm thinking in the patient that has, for instance, an excellent response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And after interval debulking surgery, instead of introducing bevacizumab, maybe that patient is very well treated with niraparib. On the other hand, those patients with homologous recombination proficient, stage 4, not very good response to chemotherapy, those patients are better treated if you add bevacizumab. That's my personal opinion. But at the end of the day, you have to individualize each patient, if the patient is suitable or not for bevacizumab, and so on. And the last comment is that for those patients, the use of PARP inhibitors sometimes can only be introduced in the frontline, because you need to demonstrate a response to platinum again to introduce the PARP. And so that's another point of consideration. If I don't give this patient PARP inhibitor now, maybe that patient in the relapse will not respond to platinum and will not be able to receive PARP. But on the contrary, you can give bevacizumab in frontline, second line, platinum resistant and platinum sensitive setting. So all these things need to be considered when making decision with the patients.
What do we know about PARP maintenance in patients with germline mutations other than BRCA? And what do we know about PARP inhibitors in patients with various types of somatic mutations, including BRCA somatic?
Well, let me start with the last question. The trials that have incorporated the PARP inhibitors have tested for BRCA in the tumor. And so far, we don't have the data, split data, of BRCA germline and BRCA somatic mutation, how the PARP inhibitor is worked in those different groups. The data that we have are coming from the second line. And in second line, it seems that BRCA somatic have the same benefit that BRCA germline mutated patients. So that's why we have assumed that all the BRCA are achieving the same benefit, and that will be the recommendation. In terms of if there are any other mutation that could lead to impressive benefit, we have also data in the second line with RAD51 mutations, but not in the front line so far. So I guess that probably there will be many translational research around. In the future, we will see more data, but right now we don't have specific data.
So again, putting aside reimbursement issues, and I'm thinking about a curve I saw last night in a breast cancer webinar of, I think it was olaparib and PALB2, like almost all the patients responded. So if you have an ovarian cancer patient with a PALB2 germline, are you going to use a PARP inhibitor theoretically?
So honestly, PALB2 is not the best predictor in ovarian. Maybe RAD51 is better if you put aside BRCA. One of the things that we have also learned is that to define homologous recombination deficiency, we need to make some kind of platform testing for the genomic instability and looking for somatic mutations in genes involved in the homologous recombination pathway is not enough, because you can miss a lot of patients. So if you have a mutation in RAD51, probably the patient will have homologous recombination deficient tumor and then will be a good candidate for PARP inhibitors.
So we talked about BRCA germline as clearly indication for switch maintenance with a PARP inhibitor. Looking through the ESMO guidelines, everybody, I think, agrees on that. My question to you is, again, putting aside reimbursement issues, which PARP inhibitor and for how long?
In the front line.
Front line, BRCA germline.
So you have two options. Olaparib 2 years, niraparib 3 years. That are the options that you have. Putting aside reimbursement and approval, I think both options are possible nowadays. There is another small things that you have to consider. For instance, and that is important from the clinical perspective, the drug interactions. Sometimes you are treating patients that are not in medication. So you can give them both olaparib or niraparib without any concern. But for some patients that do have polymedication, niraparib is probably safer because there are no interactions with the CYP450 system. Most of the drugs are metabolized at that system. So that could be one advantage. The other advantage for niraparib could be that it's given once daily. But on the other hand, if you give olaparib, you don't need to perform the weekly blood test in the first month. So both drugs are good. Both drugs have demonstrated an excellent hazard ratio. You have to manage other factors for making the decision.
What about patients who have a history of hypertension? They're already on 2 or 3 drugs. Any preference there? Is hypertension more of a problem with niraparib than olaparib, for example?
That's a good point for patients with hypertension. With 2 drugs, we try to avoid bevacizumab, and niraparib may be an issue because there is 11% hypertension with niraparib. For that specific patient, maybe olaparib is a better option. The other thing is patients that could have some problems for sleeping because niraparib can induce insomnia. That's another thing that you could consider. So this is small, as I said, small differences that you have to consider when making the decision.
Getting back to this issue of how long, you mentioned the trial, the olaparib was 2 years, niraparib was 3 years. But that's a pretty big difference to a patient to take an extra year of therapy. I have heard people say kind of like they read between the lines a little bit. And if they're going to use niraparib for BRCA germline, they might use it for 2 years. If they're going to use it and a patient is HRD proficient, they're going to use it for 3 years. Maybe they even use olaparib for more than 2 years in higher risk patients. Do you do that or do you just more stick with the trial 2 or 3 years?
It's even more complicated because the SMPC of niraparib allows the administration until progression, even longer than 3 years.
It's interesting.
I agree that there is a lot of confusion around this topic of the duration of therapy. My preference is to keep close to the design of the trial. I personally think that olaparib has data for 2 years, niraparib has data for 3 years, but there are patients that you may consider to prolong the treatment. It's not the same a patient, for instance, with a complete cytoreduction reduction in the front line that finished therapy after 2 years. That patient maybe she's cured and doesn't make sense to prolong therapy. But on the other hand, you have a patient that was stage 4, had a partial response to chemo, started the maintenance with microscopic visible disease in the CT, and you put the patient niraparib and the patient achieve a better response that is maintained for 2 or 3 years. So at that moment, I think that you can consider to have a discussion with the patient about the pros and cons of keeping the patient on treatment.
So I want to kind of get into some of the issues related to side effect management. But first, I want to bring up the issue of MDS and AML. There was a recent meta-analysis that looked at that, and then we saw data from the SOLO2 trial. Right now, how do you put it all together? If you have a patient who asks you, It kind of looks to me like it about doubles the rate. I don't know if you agree with that. And farther down the line, the baseline rate is higher. Solo 2 is 4% in the non-olaparib arm. Is that a rough ballpark of doubling the risk of MDS at this point, or we really don't know?
So I think that we have two different scenarios for this specific toxicity. One is the front line and the other is the second line. It seems that in the front line, the rate of MEL or MSD is lower than 1%, or is around 1 to 1.5%, and not very different to the control arm. And it is consistent in both trials, Paola and Prima, but also in the solo one with a longer follow-up. It's a very good news that we haven't seen new cases of leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome. That's very good. The second line is another thing. As you mentioned, in Solo 2, we observe up to 8% cases of leukemia or myelodysplastic syndrome. But those patients have received not only PARP inhibitor, but also at least twice platinum-based chemotherapy. And even in the control arm, there was a rate of 4%. So for sure, that is an issue in the long term, the leukemia. But when the patient has a relapse, and she's BRCA mutated, and she has not received PARP inhibitor in the front line, the use of olaparib or niraparib changed dramatically the natural history of those patients. And we can have even long-term responders without progression after 5 years of therapy. So we have to balance that. Obviously, we don't want to see leukemias, but we don't want to see patients progression very early.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in terms of the balancing it with the benefit, I think there's no question. But just in terms of informing the patient and what the numbers actually are. I mean, Solo 1, though, the follow-up, I think I saw 3 cases in the olaparib arm and none in the control arm. So it was 1% roughly, I think. There was 250 or 300 patients. So that doesn't prove anything, but I mean, it's a little bit. I mean, what do you tell the patient? Do you give them a 1% risk if they want to know? You have a patient as a doctor or something. What number would you give them up front, roughly?
No, you are completely right. So when we have started to introduce the olaparib, for instance, in the front line, we advise patients that there is a risk of 1% of leukemia. So maybe you are going to be cured, but there is a risk of 1% of leukemia. That's something that we tell to our patients. Yes, it is the balance between benefit and risk is in favor of the benefit.
Now, in a weird way, it kind of reminds me of some of the discussions that went on about lenalidomide in myeloma maintenance 4 or 5 years ago, because again, they saw a little bit of a bump. But again, compared to the benefit, it was like very small compared to that. So the other question I have, the curves are so amazing when you look at those progression-free survival curves. I'm kind of curious why we're not seeing a survival benefit yet.
In the front line, there is not enough follow-up. The number of events is not mature enough to see the data on overall survival in the front line. We need longer follow-up.
When you look at the control arm, though, in a way, when you think about it, and these people responded to chemotherapy, and yet on average, they relapsed in a year. I think it was 13 months or something. It's amazing how ineffective the chemo really is. And then you see this huge bump. Really interesting.
No, you have to consider that that observation is really interesting, because one of the great surprises when we saw for the first time the Solo 1 trial was the short median PFS in the control arm. So theoretically, the best population, stage 3, 75% primary debulking surgery, good hospitals, good surgeries, BRCA mutated, almost all patients in complete response, and the median PFS was roughly 1 year. What's happened? We were thinking in 2-3 years of median PFS, and that was not a reality. Maybe that will not be easy to see benefit in overall survival, because many of those patients have received PARP inhibitor in the relapse setting. There is probably some masking effect of that crossover.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I'm curious, what are some of the issues that come up in this situation? Patients already had surgery, they've had chemotherapy, and now they're getting a PARP inhibitor. Can you talk a little bit about some of the clinical issues that come up in keeping people on therapy? And of course, the two that we hear the most about are GI problems and cytopenias. What do you see in the typical patient? And how often can you not get a patient through therapy? Would you ever switch to another PARP inhibitor?
So it's roughly in the frontline, 10% of patients need to stop the PARP inhibitor due to side effects. I think that we have learned how to manage most of the side effects. And the other thing is that the patient perceives that we are convinced on what we are doing. And that is a factor that helps in the adherence of the patient to the treatment. When you, as a doctor, prescribe a medication to a patient with a strong belief that that is something that could change the natural history, could cure the patient perceives that, and the adherence is higher. But obviously, it is an issue. It is an issue to interrupt the treatment. That's why when you consider Paola, you have to consider that 20% of patients need to stop maintenance. That's something to discuss with the patient. Patients that have strong commitment with the therapy, that are fit enough, are much better treated, but patients that are not so convinced should be better treated with monotherapy, I think.
Any comment you were pointing out in the presentation that in these upfront trials, for example, SOLO 1, the patient's only got 2 years of treatment, and yet the curves continue to diverge for 5 years. It kind of reminded me actually of adjuvant endocrine therapy of breast cancer, where they saw the same thing, adjuvant tamoxifen. They stopped it at 2 years, and they still saw a delayed benefit. Any thoughts about kind of what's going on? Do you think that people are getting cured early, or why do you see this persistent separation, even though the drug's been stopped?
I think that probably the reason is because we have cured some of those patients. If you see the number of events in the first 2 to 3 years, there are still a number of events from 1 year to another. But from the third year to the fourth, and for the fourth to the fifth, the number of events is very low. It's very low. So I think that we are now brimming with the cure of some patients in the frontline.
I don't know if you're starting to see patients. It looks like not too many patients actually relapse, but particularly, I guess, in HRD proficient, if you're using it in that situation. Any thoughts about approaching the patient with recurrence after having received PARP up front? Would you rechallenge someone who'd been off therapy for a while? Do we have any evidence right now of response to another PARP inhibitor patient who's progressing on the first one?
So far, we don't have data on the PARP after PARP. I mean, data from randomized clinical trials. We have some experience, personal experience, with very few patients that they have retreated with PARP inhibitors after the relapse. What I see clear is that there are two types of patients. Patients that have progressed on PARP inhibitor in the frontline, and patients that have progressed at the end of the PARP inhibitor. So when they have finish, then they relapse 1, 2, 3, 6 months later at the end of therapy. In my view, they are two completely different populations. For patients that have completed the treatment in frontline with PARP inhibitors and then relapse, I think that you could consider again PARP inhibitor, specifically in BRCA mutated patients. For patients that have progressed on therapy, my experience is that the response to platinum is good, but not perfect, and that retreatment with PARP doesn't work. But my experience is very few patients.
What do we know about the mechanisms of resistance to PARP inhibitors biologically? Can you test for resistance mutations, for example?
So far, we have gained a great amount of data on that. One of the most clearly defined mechanisms of resistance is BRCA reversion mutation. That is a new mutation in BRCA that restores the function of the protein. That is very common. In a paper published last year in Clinical Cancer Research, it also defined a couple of additional molecular features that were associated with the progression on the retreatment with PARP inhibitor. So obviously a field of intensive research. For instance, in the ANITA trial, we have introduced translational research program in which we are having blood tests and serum for patients at each tumor assessment. One of our most important aims is to try to figure out what are the features that are related to the progression on PARP inhibitor. We are looking for serum biomarkers. That will be perfect, I think. If we identify a protein profile by Luminex or a gene profile that could be associated to the progression. That is one of our programs now.
Just the other day, an oncologist was presenting a case to me of a patient with cholangiocarcinoma who turned out to have a BRCA germline mutation. I think I've heard another case, I think it was lung cancer. The patient had a BRCA germline mutation. So obviously we don't have any data in those tumors, or I don't think we do. Do you know of any case reports? Do you think it would be rational if you ran out of options to use a PARP inhibitor in that situation?
I don't have data. Honestly, I don't have data, but I hear that there are some reports on patients with BRCA mutation tumors that are not pancreatic, breast, or ovarian responded to therapy. So again, if you have a stage 4 small cell lung cancer and you have received the standard of care and you have a BRCA mutation, I would consider PARP inhibitor.
But let me ask you, do you need another hit in the tumor inherently for a PARP inhibitor to work, or just BRCA germline's enough theoretically, biologically, to have an effect?
That is interesting because I have seen that in the ovarian cancer, the effect of PARP inhibitor is higher than in the breast cancer, even in the BRCA mutated group of patients. So what we have seen in ovarian is that you have a BRCA mutation and you have not received PARP inhibitor before, you can respond to PARP alone, and the response rate may be close to 80%, which is very high. But in the breast cancer BRCA-mutated patients, the response rate is not so high, even in BRCA-mutated patients. Maybe there are another mechanisms. Or maybe that in ovarian cancer, the BRCA is clearly a driven mechanism of alteration in the cell that is not compensated by another mechanisms.
We're going to present a case, again, I just heard yesterday, amazing case of this patient who was 80 years old, who had a BRCA2 germline mutation. And interestingly, her daughter had been diagnosed with breast cancer like 10 years before and was found to have a BRCA mutation with breast cancer. They screened the family, the younger members, but they didn't screen her because she was in her 70s. So that was the first thing I thought was really interesting. And the second thing is the patient had really extensive disease in the abdomen and walked in there saying, I want to go to hospice. I'm not having surgery. I don't want to be treated. I'm 80 years old. And the doc convinced her to just take a few doses of carboplatin and olaparib. Now it's 3 years later. She's NED, doing great. But what struck me was she never had surgery. And it kind of underlies your point of how effective these drugs are in BRCA mutated disease. Any thoughts about that case?
It's a really amazing case, I think. That lady was in the hospice and somebody rescued her from there. My thought is that when you see a patient, it doesn't matter the age, it doesn't matter the disease, you have to look for minimum space to help that patient. And if the patient has a BRCA mutation, why don't try platinum-based therapy, even in small doses, if the patient has enough performance status? Well, I agree with that philosophy.
The other thing that's really interesting is really she didn't need to go through any of this stuff if they had just taken out her ovaries 10 years previously. I mean, I guess they probably would have done that. I don't know what they would have done about the breast, but even breast, I guess she was in her early 70s, so the whole thing could have been avoided, but I just thought it was really an amazing case. And also, you were talking about breast not being as responsive, but the prostate looks pretty good to me. Prostate almost seems like ovary. I don't know. Is that your take? It seems much more sensitive. I know it's indirect, but just comparing it to breast. Any thoughts about that? And pancreas.
Well, I think I saw more similarity between prostate and breast than prostate and ovarian, honestly. Maybe that hormone therapy is working. But what we have seen now is that the BRCA is a syndrome. It's not only restricted to one or two diseases. it's a syndrome. And even in the prostate cancer, we are seeing that HRD probably is also making some differences. It's not only the BRCA.
No, I tell you, we've done CME programs where we bring together prostate people, GYN people, breast, and GI. And it's really amazing to see people comparing notes. One other issue that I've gotten into in those kinds of things, some people think that the toxicity of PARP inhibitors is greater in patients with BRCA germline mutations, but I don't know that that's true.
That's not true. We have explored, we have analyzed that specific question, and we haven't seen any difference between BRCA and non-BRCA patients.
And again, they don't have the other hit in their normal cells, so that's the way I understand at my basic level. So the final thing I want to ask you about was this new strategy of combining checkpoint inhibitors and PARP inhibitors. And I have to say, I have a little skepticism. It seems like everybody adds IOs to everything in trials, and I'm sure some of that's going to end up working. But we'll say that you've talked about the Mediola data, and that looked pretty interesting. So first of all, from your own point of view, biologically, where do you see the synergy between these two?
Well, I agree with you that we have moved the checkpoint inhibitors in ovarian cancer to frontline, even to second line without NAF background. You are completely right. The problem is that the high-grade serous ovarian cancer is a disease with low TMB, tumor mutational burden, low GEP, gene expression profile, that is also a biomarker for response to these therapies. So for sure, it's not the best disease for immune therapy alone. And that's why we think that combinations can be the solution for incorporating checkpoint inhibitors in ovarian cancer. But we have the first disappointing results with the imaging 015 study with the combination of bevacizumab and atezolizumab. And now we are looking forward to the results of the combination with PARP inhibitors. PARP inhibitors produce an interesting effect that is upregulation of the STING pathway. STING pathway is the stimulation of the interferon pathway. That could be the reason why PARP inhibitors are synergistic with the anti-PD-L1. But that is a biological hypothesis that we need to demonstrate in our clinics.
One of the things I like about the Mediola study is it brought in bevacizumab, and seems like we're seeing more IO anti-angiogenic combinations, Vitezo-Bev and HCC, hepatocellular cancer, obviously renal cell, TKI plus IO has been looked at. Any reason to think that that strategy, and actually I think there were some patients in the LEAP trial of Penbo-Lenvatinib that had ovary, in a small number, but and they looked like they had some responses. What about the strategy of IO, angiogenic, and PARP, which is kind of what they did in Mediola? It looked like those patients did better.
Yes, the data of Mediola are amazing with 87% response rate, but it is in a small cohort, and you have seen several times in our career that the combination in a small group of patients has shown impressive results. And then when we have moved to the randomized trials, that is not so impressive. It's amazing. It's better to have that than the contrary, specifically for those trials that are incorporating bevacizumab, PARP inhibitor, and anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 in the front line. But we need to wait. I will be very cautious with those data. And you have mentioned also the LEAP-005. I presented in the IGCS last year the data for ovarian cancer. And they are pretty good. We included patients in fifth line. Patients need to have received fourth prior lines of therapy. Pembro and lenvatinib achieved a 35% response rate. Patients extremely pretreated. Well, safety is a challenge with that combination, but our rate of discontinuation was not higher than in the endometrial cancer, for instance. And I think this is one of the combinations that we need to explore, not with bevacizumab, but with TKI. We are also running now combinations of lucitanib with nivolumab, for instance, also in ovarian cancer.
I didn't realize you presented that. There was like 34 patients. Is that the same thing you're talking about?
You are right.
Right.
You are right. It's probably 34 patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Gonzalez Martin, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.